Right, thank you very much. We are now moving into the last but not least the session on governance, or related issue of governance. Can I basically briefly introduce the chair of the governance panel, who will subsequently introduce the speakers. So it's great pleasure also to have Dr. Catherine Allerton, who is associate professor in the anthropology department here at the LSE, and who is also SEAC Center associate. Catherine has been conducting research on child and childhood, especially in the context of Indonesia, a village context of Indonesia, and also urban context of Malaysia. So, Catherine, over to you.
Thank you. We have all our speakers. Well, we don't quite have our third speaker, but I think we'll go ahead and start. So welcome to the last panel discussion. This is on electoral politics in Southeast Asia from a grassroots perspective. And I'll just introduce the three panelists for you and give the title of their talk and then hand over to them. So we'll start with Ms. Isabel Dunstan, who's an Academy Associate at Chatham House. And she'll be talking about how securitization of the internet challenges democratic gains in Southeast Asia. And then we'll have Dr. Marlena Lim, who is an associate professor at Carleton University and currently a senior visiting fellow here at the LSE's Southeast Asia Center. And she'll be talking about nationalism, religion, and media for electoral politics in Southeast Asia. And then we'll finish with Dr. Maung Zani, who's co-founder of Forces for Renewal in Southeast Asia. And he'll be talking about the electoral politics of race, ethnicity, gender, class, and faith in post-independence colonial states in Southeast Asia. So over to you, Isabel.
How's everyone going? Good. Thank you so much for joining us to the end of the day. We've got some juicy discussion ahead of us, I hope. Thank you for the warm introduction and to my fellow panelists. It's been a great day, and thank you to Professor Shin and Dr. Mega and team. Thank you so much for organizing today. So today I'd like to talk about how internet securitization is challenging democratic gains in Southeast Asia, with a particular focus on Indonesia. This is under, I guess, an umbrella theme of democratic internet governance. So I'm going to start my presentation with a motorbike, because what's a forum about Southeast Asia without motorbikes? So about 8 months before the presidential and parliamentary election in Indonesia, Joko Widodo, commonly known as Jokowi, tore down the streets in Jakarta on a motorbike. He arrived at the city's new sports stadium in front of a roaring crowd at the opening of the Asian Games. The stunt appeared on televisions throughout the country, and video footage flooded social media for 24 hours. It was an international presentation of his cool confidence in his relationship with the public. But behind the scenes, his election campaign members were very worried. Black campaigning and disinformation had begun to challenge Jokowi's future presidency. It was possible fake news accusing him of being a communist of Chinese descent would threaten his campaign and chip away at the polls that had been in his favour for months, years. Disinformation, or hoax as it's locally known, has been deeply networked in Indonesia. And it's monetized by groups of buzzers or groups of social media workers who might have multiple accounts, sometimes fake accounts, and they're employed by untraceable actors. A number of research pieces have come out now about network disinformation in the Philippines and Indonesia. So at the same time, it wasn't just one-sided. Jokowi's opponent, Prabowo Subianto, was also the subject of black campaigning, allegedly driven by underground supporters of Jokowi. So a democratic threat was evident. I've got some examples here of some disinformation pieces that went viral. And when we're talking about viral in Indonesia, we're talking about millions of people seeing this and shaping their views of their country and of their leaders. This first one here is circled with a young man here circled, which appeared to be Jokowi at a Communist Party rally, but well before Jokowi was actually born, so obviously fake news. And then this other piece was Prabowo at a rally where he's appears to be shaking hands with a supporter, but what was sent viral was that Prabowo was actually manhandling and being aggressive with a supporter, so it suggested that he was being aggressive. So in response, the government's Information and Communications Ministry, in coordination with cyber police units, developed a number of strategies to limit the spread of hoax. This included detection of disinformation using artificial intelligence, the removal of content and censorship blocking, criminal prosecution of those who spread the content, and wide-scale throttling of internet access, which I'll talk about later. This approach to tackling disinformation has since worried digital rights activists, raising concern that rather than effectively drowning out hoax peddlers, it's instead had a silencing effect, warning journalists and netizens, us, that if we publish something offensive or innocently wrong about a person in a position of power, they could be facing exorbitant fines and jail time. President Jokowi has been re-elected as president for his second term, as we know. He has great ambitions to develop Indonesia as a digital powerhouse of Southeast Asia. He's referred to Jakarta as a potential Silicon Valley of Indonesia. His strategic outlook is known as Indonesia 4.0. And if he succeeds, digital expansion will play a role in every aspect of Indonesia's development, including science, infrastructure, agriculture. The result will be wide-scale connectivity, and not just connectivity in terms of trade and transport, but connectivity in terms of social networks and more people online, more satellites, and the deregulation in the telecommunications sector. This is no doubt an exciting prospect. But as more people come online, digital innovation does not just result in more business. In free societies, online spaces should be as democratic as public spaces, where people can buy, sell, express themselves, mobilise. But with all democratic spaces, as we know, come laws and regulations to prevent and punish bad behaviour. But to date, policy regulators worldwide, particularly in fragile states and emerging markets, have not been ready for the threats and risks that digital economies bring, such as disinformation and security attacks. Nor have they been ready for the wave of cross-generational online participation and increased capacity for freedom of expression that has come with social media. So this year has presented three key moments or flashpoints that have tested Indonesia's readiness for a healthy online democratic environment. First is the 2019 presidential and parliamentary election. Second, unrest in Papua. And thirdly, recent protests in response to anti-corruption reform and changes to the criminal code. We can agree that it's been a very busy year in Indonesia. So, flashpoint one. 22 criminal charges were made between September 2018 and April 2019 under the controversial Information and Transaction Law, which is basically Indonesia's de facto fake news law. For example, arrests included an Achenese man spreading disinformation about Jokowi being a communist through his Instagram account. Police also charged academic lecturer Robertus Robert for singing a song that challenged military presence in the public service. He sang it outside the presidential palace. And even though this was not an online activity, his song was then published on YouTube, and for that reason he was charged. and that led to his arrest. The ministry also employed artificial intelligence software called Cyberdrone 9 to trawl social networks and websites for online content that could be deemed as disinformation. So once it was detected and then verified by staff within the ministry, it would request Google, Facebook, Twitter to remove it. It's still unknown how much content has actually been removed or what content was removed. There's a vast lack of transparency around this. However, local representatives from the tech giants claim that content is not removed if it's considered lawful. So, for example, these representatives have said that if it's simply criticism of the government, that is lawful. However, pornographic content, not lawful, so that content has been removed. Flashpoint 2. In August, the Ministry of Communication stated that it had deliberately slowed down internet speeds for 3 days in several parts of Papua, following the deaths of 21 people as a result of clashes between authorities and the public. They claimed that these clashes could be worsened if disinformation spread online. From a ministerial perspective, the throttling was to reduce further violence and miscommunication. Yet, at the same time, rights groups argued that full access to internet and information was critical at times of crisis to protect people and allow them to access information they needed. Flashpoint 3. In September, students in cities throughout the country demonstrated against reform that would reduce the authority of the Anti-Corruption Commission, the KAPEKA. Students also protested against fundamental changes to the criminal code related to freedom of speech, abortion rights, extramarital sex, among a number of other reforms. Without notice or transparent communication, the government once again throttled the internet. When I mean throttling, I mean slowing down of the internet, not just blocking it entirely. So it prevents people from distributing, uploading, publishing rich content like videos and images and memes, for example. The Southeast Asia Freedom of Expression Network, SafeNet, in a recent petition called on the government to stop limiting the public's access to the internet, arguing that the internet slowdown, blocking of content, and monitoring of social media accounts was going beyond stopping fake news. It was fundamentally limiting democratic practices of the right to information and the right to mobilise, the right to freedom of speech and criticism of the government. A joint UN statement in 2015 stressed that based on the Human Rights Act, network outages cannot be justified of any kind. So this is a net freedom, an internet freedom map, and I've included the entire world here, but not every country is included in this survey. So you can see that not free is the blue, and partly free is, that's actually supposed to be yellow, that little white dot, and then free is the green. So you can see that Indonesia here is yellow and it's considered partly free. So it appears these acts of securitization of the internet in Southeast Asia will continue. Disinformation has entered the ASEAN agenda as a security concern, and nations are sharing learnings related to respective fake news laws. However, as Dr. Gulizar Hachiyakapoglu for The Diplomat says, Southeast Asia is made up of different disinformation landscapes, and they have context-specific fractures that are vulnerable to different disinformation landscapes and exploitation. There are impediments to cooperation like we've seen in the EU and UK. But instead, we do see some patterns. As we've just heard right now about the Philippines, Cambodia also has measures to block media it deems as a security threat. Myanmar has seen journalists in prison for published information of the government the government deems false. And Singapore has now criminalised false information online, whereby malicious actors face $37,000 fine and 5 years in prison for sharing false content. Information and democracy expert Cherry and George recently described this law in Singapore as tilting the marketplace of ideas in favour of ruling party politicians. So zooming back to Indonesia, last week President Jokowi responded to a question by Bloomberg's editor-in-chief John Micklethwaite. Micklethwaite asked, regarding the protests in Hong Kong, are you on the side of the people or the government? And President Jokowi responded indirectly but emphatically, Indonesia adalah democracy. Indonesia is a democracy. So protests are normal, he said. In a democracy, protests are guaranteed by the Constitution. People can express their opinion about laws, about policy. There is no problem. Acts of securitisation such as blocking, throttling, criminal prosecution could create barriers to Jokowi's vision of it being a democracy. In 2018, Indonesia rated as partly free in Freedom House's Freedom of the Net survey. It rated just under India, the Ukraine and Kyrgyzstan. It lost points due to access to the internet. That means just the number of people who are able to access the internet or not, or have access to the technology and infrastructure, and those who do not, and censorship of the content. But this doesn't take into consideration the 2019 year's outages and throttling. So as Indonesia 4.0 is realised, the internet needs to be considered as much more of a democratic space as much as it is a marketplace. So I didn't want to raise too many problems without raising some solutions. So here are my recommendations. I'm running out of time. So generally my recommendations are regarding the international cooperation against disinformation with a human rights approach. Abolishing fake news laws, but it appears that they're here to stay and they will strengthen. So if they are in existence, they should include clear caveats and civil treatment of the law, not criminal, to ensure freedom of speech is protected and they don't just serve those in power. And I urge governments and civil society to invest far more in critical digital literacy. That's not just how to use mobile phones and use computers, but understanding news literacy and digital citizenship, how to be a good netizen, through existing civil society organisations. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Isabel. Perfectly timed. And now we have Dr. Merlina Lim.
The later the day, the gloomier our forum is, right? Like, kind of like, and I, my presentation is kind of gloomy too, but but I will start with something yummy. How many of you know rendang?
Yes.
Right? I don't have a picture because it will raise some controversy if I don't put a right picture of rendang. It's a dry curry dish where the meat is stewed in coconut milk, smell really good, and spices until it is tender, right? So it's dry, but it's wet. And since we are in London, we are in the UK, so I want to recall a rendang gate. It was actually last year in an episode, April episode of the MasterChef UK. A Malaysian chef was eliminated from the quarterfinals of the reality TV show, remember that, right? That was bigger than Brexit in Southeast Asia. The judges has criticized the Malaysian-born chef Zaleha Kadir Olpin's nasi lemak, which is rice meal, with one judge, Greg Wallace, which is London-based chef, saying the chicken rendang that accompanied the meal, the main dish, was not crispy enough. That was enough to rile up most Malaysians, Indonesians, Bruneis, and Singaporeans, and all rendang lovers in the world united in one voice on social media saying that chicken rendang should never be crispy. Yes, exactly. If nothing else, it got Najib Razak, at that moment was the Prime Minister of Malaysia, and his political nemesis, Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, on the same page. That was impossible. Don't mess with our rendang. Here, the British just has done impossible, the impossible. Managing to unite two political rivals, as well half of the social media user in the region, in defending non-crispy, authentic rendang. So the story illustrates the landscape of social media discourse in politics, especially electoral politics. when people connect, collectivize, and even unite based on the same enemy or a perceived enemy. Essentially, our cluster on binary discourse, anti-X or pro-X. If you don't like war on drug, you are anti-Duterte, regardless what you say. If you don't like Jokowi's policy on Papua, you are anti-nationalistic. And there is no space for other type of discourse. While facilitating grassroots participation, the contemporary media landscape, where your social media are large part of it, it doesn't equally promote and empower all voices. What are amplified? That is the main question for today. So I just go through a big picture here. So East Asia is interesting because it's actually none of the countries considered fully democratic, right? Having said that, I will not just go through, this is from Economist Intelligence Unit, the latest data from 2018. And literally one of the most authoritarian region in the world. It's like very complicated. You have the range, but essentially there is no free democratic country. Having said that, if you look at the election timeline, it's pretty noisy. We have election all the time. Even Vietnam has election in 2011. You probably didn't know that, right? I checked Wikipedia before coming here. But it is like literally, but having said that, it's either electoral authoritarianism or it is binary politics. It's essentially don't really have plurality of voices or choices. When we have our paper vote, people are under illusion, they have choices, but essentially you vote on X or anti-X. Today is X, X against, X again, occasionally anti-X. And social media, how social media is positioned within this is actually, therefore, should be taken into consideration. The political landscape in which social media operates is actually very important. And this is social media in Southeast Asia. Look at mobile phone subscription. It's impressive. There are more mobile phones than people in Indonesia. You know, actually, they're like 100-something%. The babies probably have phones, right? I don't know. You're born and you have like two phones. Like, so it is interesting. And I think that people, early literature on digital divide emphasized on access. What does it mean, though? Right? What does it mean to have mobile phone? Does it mean more participation? Probably so. Because Manila is the texting, the messaging, texting capital of the world. And Jakarta is the capital of Twitter, because it's like, well, both of the cities have a lot of traffic jams. People text. So essentially, I think what we see that, and I don't have that much time, but I have one piece recently that's talking about, you know, access and divide, and essentially doesn't really parallel with really real participation. What does it mean to participate? What does it mean to be vibrant and engaged citizen? I will not go through that, I'm just going. So, and I think today I will focus on why is it that we have this, I think, wonderful, very, very wonderful and important keynotes from government, which is populism, right? There is a, so how we understand social media and contemporary media landscape in influence and implication of social media in politics should also be understood within the landscape on how nationalism is on the rise and how religion of all kind, of ideologies of all kind, being embedded within this rise of nationalism and how religion and media are embedded in the process. So it is like mediatization and the religionization of nationalism, basically, right? And social media doesn't really amplify all kind, but there is certain type practices and rhetorics and imagination and ideology. So what we see here, for example, these are Twitter. I have hundreds of pictures like this if you are interested in looking at, but today I just showed two of them. One from Malaysia is essentially showing a snapshot of 100,000 tweets using related hashtag, and it seems to be vibrant, right? On the surface, it seems to be like there are multiple clusters, so different color, different clustering. These are tweets and the notes of people who are tweeting. However, if you look deeper, essentially, it really about is divided into Pakatan Harapan, which is Alliance of Hope, and Barisan Nasional Front, National Front, and Mahathir, and those who don't like Mahathir, right? And over time, this is actually a quite, the Malaysian picture is quite like Indonesian Twitter first back in 2014, which things looks vibrant, but underneath there are sort of like very oversimplified type of discourse that hegemonize the entire discourse. It's not like there are no other meaningful discourse about policy and other things, except that over time, there are two things, exist binary. No matter how hard you try to resist against oversimplification of narratives and rhetorics, seemingly is impossible. And these are Indonesia look like that before, and then now 2019 election, basically Jokowi Prabowo, right? And it's not only that. From 2014 to 2019, literally, social media discourse is divided into two, almost like, and then you go to other kind of gubernatorial election, which is Ahok, which is against anti or anti, and nationalist narrative, which is NKRI Harga Mati, which is called like NKRI Harga Mati, the nation, the United, the Republic of Indonesia, United Republic of Indonesia is a fixed price, Harga Mati, you shouldn't negotiate, and anybody who questions the policies or kind of trying to put nuance being labeled as anti-nationalistic. And this is going on, and eventually, almost there is no, I have 5 minutes, that's too much. So basically, right, this is what we deal with. But that's only in Indonesia or in Malaysia, which is, I think, right now, the conversation almost like going to similar direction. And when religion is introduced into this discourse and it's become even more ultra-nationalistic, populist in nature, like anybody speak for Rohingya, for example, right, being like, oh, you are anti-Hmong, anti-nationalistic, and you are, okay, and then the anti-Muslim sentiment is very, very, very thick in that, right? But also there is a this type of discourse is also necessarily painted, sometimes it masquerade in the sort of like human right, pro-human right kind of discourse like in Indonesia or pluralistic voice, but it's really for self-interested certain group and denying the rights of others. Any pro-Ahok in 2017 gubernatorial election, which is supposedly championing pluralism, right, denying the voice of the others, Ahmadiyya, Papuans, and other types of religions, different Islam that don't really match, different kind of Buddhism that don't match, right? And this is like become a feature of discourse in the region. So essentially what I'm trying to explain here is what we deal is restorative machinery, but which is I call election machinery, which is based on marketing politics that operates not only during the election, but making politics is all about electoral politics, making election, the choices, not necessarily procedural election, the choices between two and as a permanent type of politics that being deployed through all kind of media and party, non-party politics, elites, media, which is very highly concentrated in Southeast Asia, and social media consultant being together, and they work on politics based on the process of branding, personalization, work through effect rather than rational discourse, and working through personal visibility and economy of attention. Bites, simplified narratives actually works better. And no, you don't need nuance. There is no space for nuance. And within this, even though digital grassroots trying, you have activism, right? Eventually being trapped into that mode of binary discourse, because digital grassroots also have fans, people who think they are doing the movement, but they are essentially revolve, their practices revolve around personas. And how this machinery work with the fandom activism, actually they become a strong feature of campaigns, media campaigns, media politics. And as a result, you have a strong tendency to actually perpetuate populist rhetoric, populist style, whether it's a technocratic populism or a theocratic populism. I should end there, but it sounds very gloomy. But I think the virtue of doing research, when I go places, doing field research, not only online, is I see many hope, spaces of hope. They are small, what I call network spaces of hopes. And these could only happen if you scale down the activities and slow down, which is going back to the first keynote, the human rights defenders that works online and offline, for example, in the Philippines. The network spaces of hopes is our only hopes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If you'll all save your questions until the end of the last talk. And so now we have Dr. Maung Zani.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. You know, I'm the last speaker, and I was very delighted that many of you stick around, because the politics and also the discussions around the technocratic urban cities or smart cities could really drain you. And for somebody who wakes up every day angry at everything, it's amazing that your level of your staying power. Because we are in one of the most renowned and vibrant intellectual institutions in the world, I should say something about what I call the epistemic politics that confronts people like myself and some of you in this room that have chosen to get involved, to align yourself with what Franz Fanon called the wretched of the earth, the oppressed, the underdog. Because in area studies, as most of you will know, like anthropology and colonialism, area studies and states are like twins, inseparable. The few, the centers themselves, were born out of military strategic purposes or missions pursued by Western powers. So if you are an academic based in any academic institutions, or if in a think tank, you would proudly say, I advised such and such government. It would be on your resume. I advised the United Nations, EU, ADB, World Bank, IMF, and so on and so forth. And that sort of enhances your prestige. Yeah. The state listens to you. And because you are operating within the zone that the state feels comfortable. But for those of us who have chosen to use our skills and understandings and insights to support and be in solidarity with those who struggle for their rights, their dignity, their well-being, we would be considered, or our expertise would be considered ideologically driven, or we are too angry, too emotional. You're supposed to be really calm, because the calmer you get, the more credible your expertise is. So I was very, very grateful when I saw the program to the organizers, particularly Professor Shin and his colleagues, Dr. Lee, when they included those of us who chose to operate in opposition to what we consider repressive, predatory, and internally colonial states from Southeast Asia. This panel is dear to me because I have never voted in any national election. I am 56. I lived under General Ne Win's military rule until the country exploded into a democratic uprisings. Following Philippines' example in 1986, we had an uprising in 88. Those uprisings were preceded by Gwangju uprising in South Korea in 1980-81. I lived in the U.S. for 17 years. I live in this country for 15 years. Only about 3 months ago, I had a taste of voting in a genuine local county or provincial election in this country. Think about it. 56 years of my life, I have never had the right, I wouldn't say privilege, the right to vote, to choose, to support a candidate I think, or a party that I think could advance the welfare of the local communities. Yeah? So that's why I and a few other exiles from Southeast Asia, from Cambodia, from Malaysia, from Thailand, Philippines, we decided that as trained academics or ex-academics or intellectuals, we would mobilize brain powers among exiles as well as those in the region. We would mobilize the energy on the streets of Jakarta, Manila, Rangoon, Bangkok, whatever the capitals are, to fight back the repressive states. That's why I loaded my title. You know, if you read my title, you would know it's loaded. I don't call post-colonial states. I call post-independence colonial states. The white men folded their civilizing missions 60, 70 years ago, depending on which decade your country became independent. But the brown men or the yellow men continue to behave as if they were the new masters towards the electorates or those outside the electoral spaces. So I have a few remarks. Because Southeast Asia has 11 countries and quite a few nations that have been colonized by the political, predatory, and ethnicized states across the region. Within the ASEAN, we don't have Timor-Leste. And if you're from Indonesia and critical, you know that West Papua is a colony. Or if you're from Burma, you know that we've got more than one ethnic nation that has been colonized. The independence in 1948 for Burma simply means for the non-dominant ethnic groups, basically release from one clutch of colonialism to another clutch of colonialism. Only this time, the new masters are your neighbors. They look like you. So instead of like going through detailed examples, I've decided to offer five observations that I have developed over the years. I've been an activist for 30 plus years, and in those years I've also been an engaged scholar, a student of society and politics. One is democracy. You know, I was in Kuala Lumpur back in February when our initiative called Forces of Renewal Southeast Asia was launched. Dr. Mahathir came to deliver the keynote address. That was preceded by a very, very unseemly partner that supported us, Professor Noam Chomsky. Both in their 90s, they're very, very radically different public figures. They're very with different politics. When Chomsky and Mahathir came together to support what we're trying to do, then we know that we are on the right trajectory. Mahathir was one of the people who promoted this bogus and orientalist notion of Asian values. And Lee Kuan Yew was another one, Suharto, Ne Win, all of those dead dictators ran with this idea that democracy and human rights were alien values unsuited to local customs, and we Asians must craft our own political systems. But you know, if I offer you a cup of, or a glass of water, you don't expect to drop dead. By drinking it, you don't expect to become obese over a period of time, or you don't expect to get drunk. Water is water anywhere in the world. There's soft water, there is hard water, there's mountain water, mineral water, but nonetheless, water is a life-sustaining liquid that we all need. So if you say democracy, you don't expect to get shot because you say, I don't like government policies, or Hun Sen is corrupt, or Thai monarch is a sociopath. And when you get shot, or when you are made to disappear, when your journalists are locked up, or driven out of the country, or in the case of Khashoggi, dismembered in a consulate, and yet you hold the elections, you hold up these trappings of democratic institutions, the parliament, the constitution that says that power emanates from people. Then you show like a checks and balances nominally, judiciary. There is judiciary. And then you continue to carry out your murderous exploitative policies. Then you cannot call this type of system that has been on offer for almost 70 years for some countries that have been independent at the end of World War II, a democracy. That's why Marilyn, correct me if I don't pronounce your name wrong, when she said she ranked those countries, 10 countries within ASEAN, flawed democracy, flawed. I was expecting maybe semi-functioning democracy. I was delighted to learn that there's somebody who is more critical than I. So flawed democracy. So this is the region that I will call the dark region. However, the shocking thing is that the trajectory and historical development of democratic institutions and electoral politics in Southeast Asia rhyme with the rise of democracies over the last 2,000 years or however in what we now call the West. That's the essence of Professor Chomsky's keynote opening address at our launch in KL. Democracy has been a painful struggle, violent or peaceful, armed resistance or sit-in. Someone talked about Magna Carta. You know, this was like the power sharing between the barons and the king in this country. It had nothing to do with the people. There was no such concept as people in Magna Carta. Yeah? So let's not euphemize or romanticize the role of Magna Carta. Think about it. From the time Magna Carta was signed in the middle of 13th century, women and propertyless white English or Scottish or other men in this country, it took for them to get the right to vote about 700 years. Yeah? Women in this country did not get admitted to university until the turn of the 20th century, because they were considered inferior in intellectual capacity. And working men did not get the right to vote, white men. So what we have in Southeast Asia is colonial states, yeah, run by brown men that inherited that the political DNA. And that's when, like, you know, the colonial empires were not simply about economic exploitation. They were about institutionalizing pseudoscientific notions of races in Europe that rose in the mid-1900s. So that's why we have today in places like Burma, nations trapped in a centralizing and states, political states, that refuse to grant them beyond formal recognition of them as citizens, you know, equal nationality status. So I have a few slides I just want to show here. So this is the dark region. That's why I put the question mark. The second one is, this was in 1991. In the insert is General Ne Win. Vote will not change anything. Yeah, Burma was just about to go to the polls for the first time since Ne Win came to power in 1962. Vote will not change anything. And vote has not changed anything 25 years on. This is the Guardian front page celebrating NLD landslide win after Aung San Suu Kyi herself contested. And then there were two editorials on democracy and rule of law, one on British politics. The chief of staff of the British Armed Forces made a threatening remark about Jeremy Corbyn's open refusal to use nuclear weapons in the event Britain's under attack. So the Guardian editors had a review, editorial one. The second one is, you know, cautious celebration of new electoral democracy in Burma. And the other side is I, breaking with the mainstream, I said this election is not a win for Aung San Suu Kyi or the public. And this election merely serves to legitimize the Burmese military. And then finally, because the state in Burma has turned genocidal towards one particular ethnic community that was recognized fully as our citizens and an ethnic community, Rohingya, I spoke out against it. So this is in one of the this is a paper run by military intelligence, and this gentleman is a Rohingya gentleman. So me looking Mongoloid with the slanted eyes And then, you know, Nurul Islam looking visibly South Asian man. So this is a signal that I embrace the other. So therefore, I am the enemy of the state. So the idea that political state and civil society are neutral electoral processes or involved in it, and I think when society, the state, political state turns genocidal, either through mobilizing the public opinion or resorting to outright violence, we have to call into question the notion of civil society as inherently progressive, because genocides are crimes where states and societies, ethnicized societies, interface to commit the eradication or annihilation of a particular group. So a country like Burma cannot progress, either politically or economically, despite the elections, despite the Nobel Prize winning opposition leader. You know where she is today. Yeah? And so I think my last word would be, we cannot romanticize either we the people nor the state as Democrats. And so that's why this is not a grassroots perspective that I'm presenting. If I were a grassroots perspective person here, I would be spitting out anti-Muslim racism. That is where the Burmese society is today. Therefore, as intellectuals, as dissidents, as Democrats, the best for us is to stay vigilant of both the state and civil societies and their worst tendencies. Thank you.
Yes. Well, thank you to all our panelists. Fantastic, interesting panel. And I'm sure we've got lots of questions. So, I invite you to ask questions for individual speakers or perhaps general questions that you'd like to address to all three of the panel members. Any question? Yes, do we have a microphone? There's a gentleman here.
Thank you. Okay, I have two questions, one to Dr. Lim. You showed how there is a polarization often between candidates, but on the other hand, we know that under the surface, these candidates often have a lot of negotiations with different factions and have to actually manage a lot of different interests. Can you comment maybe on the aspect that despite there's polarism maybe in social media and towards the public, there's a lot of diversity actually that's being managed by different candidates, and it's not just two sides that are opposing each other? And the second question to the last speaker, could you comment on something where maybe some would argue, well, we should engage with government on those issues, etc. This idea of engaging with current governments and how you would see that in comparison to the advice or the take that you presented.
Thank you. Dr. Lim?
Thank you for the question. So, diversity. Oops, sorry. Yes and not, actually. What appears as diversity, right? I think it's probably Malaysia, the opposition, not know, is become the ruling coalition, started with diversity, right? And diversity has a nice ring to it, but it's very challenging to deal with. In fact, that's precisely why the previous coalition during the two elections, right, not quite winning, because they had to deal with internal differences between DAP and the three big parties, and then eventually when they decided to have brand, which is Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, which is simplifying the rhetorics That's precisely where they actually gain more votes. So what we see is the limit of diversity in the actual discourse. And Indonesia, the same thing, many parties. But if you can help me point it out what are actually essentially when it comes to the substance, right? Because they are not really offering anything alternative trajectories for Indonesia in terms of how to deal with inequality or justice, for example, right? It's all literally divided into two in the end, right? And the rest is negotiation. Once you are elected, you don't have to be divided again. You could, well, come on, Prabowo now is actually the Minister of Defense, right? So even the rhetoric of division to polarize the public is not the actual division, because negotiation and transaction and contracts between parties and political actors is actually stronger than the public sentiment and voices. So polarization is a tactic. I think the keynote actually of the governance, I think Professor Pimentel Simbulan really showed that, you know, populist strongman authoritarian leaders or regime benefits from polarization, because polarization, especially in populist style, endorses a kind of moralistic, right? Like kind of like, okay, you are with us or not, because otherwise you are evil or anti-nationalistic or anti-Islam or anti-Buddhist or anything. So that's what on the rhetoric level. On the practice, is still the old corrupt. In the Philippines, it is still bossism. I think Professor Seidel, John Seidel, called it bossism culture. And KKN in corruption, coalition, and nepotism in both Malaysia and Indonesia is still going on, even though people perceive the new regimes are more kind of like they're cleaners.
Can we move on to Dr. Zani, your response?
Yeah, on engagement, you know, the pros and cons. I think if we're in the 1930s, the word's not engagement, it was appeasement. You know, Chamberlain, having met Hitler and being charmed by the great orator, the Nazi, he came back and said, he made peace with Hitler, and the rest is history. I think, I don't say don't engage, because, you know, states are going to have, interstate relations, but engage with conditions. Particularly when you know, based on numerous United Nations independent finding reports, or fact-finding missions reports, or the, numerous studies looking into the persecution of an entire national minority. The facts are there, you know. I think if you look at the history of Nazism and Nazi persecution of the Jewish people and other victims of the Nazi regime, the Polish resistance at the time based in London or like a UK was receiving reports from Auschwitz escapees what was happening. And there's a report that later became a book called London Has Been Informed. It's not that the state's officials do not know what's happening is genocide. You know, I have like a German Foreign Office officials saying the places where Rohingyas are kept inside Burma are concentration camps. This is coming from from German officials, yeah? And so the problem is we have international legal instruments. Say, for instance, like Genocide Convention, you know, the child rights. You know, every child born in a country, anywhere in the world, has the right to a nationality. Many governments sign and ratify child rights, and there are 150 UN member states that have signed the Genocide Convention, and Burma is one of them. We ratify it, and we have legal instruments. We have, you know, studies. We have conceptual tools. And even governments like Canada that have unanimously, through the parliament, passed a motion saying that this is genocide, or House of Representatives in Washington, D.C., calling it genocide almost unanimously. And all of these entities fall short of demanding that international legal instruments that were designed to prevent and punish any genocidal leaders and states be triggered. No. So that's why we have, finally, I think we have a situation, we haven't progressed since Westphalia. Sovereign states are allowed to do anything they pleases to the populations within their bounded territories. Insofar as global capital can move in, corporations can go in and set up shops, World Bank can finance social assessment projects and whatnot. So as long as you don't disrupt the international capitalist interactions, don't blow up the oil tankers or block these Straits of Hormuz, and then you will have massive cluster bombs and carpet bombings from the United States and allies. But you can decimate 1 million people, you know, declare 4 million Assamese Muslims stateless overnight, or lock up Uyghurs, 3 million, 2 million, whatever the numbers, in what we know as a concentration camp. No one raises any issue. Business as usual.
Thank you. Let's take a couple more questions. Did you have a question here? Did you have a question? Yeah, just wait for the microphone. I'll take two questions together. So one here and then one at the back. Yeah.
So my question actually for my fellow Indonesian friend here, Dr. Lim. So, Dr. Lim, do you think is there any hope for non-voter in the future election of Indonesia? Because the non-voter population in Indonesia is getting bigger compared to the previous election. Just curiosity.
Thank you. And just at the back there in the suit, we'll just take two together.
Hi. This question is to Dr. Merlina and also Dr. Zarni. So, how you characterize the state as an independent entity against the wishes of the people? I think it's also the case that the state has succeeded in propagandizing all of these things. So like the war on drugs or the anti-Muslim rhetoric. The state has accumulated support from the majority of the people, and that's why they can act on this. So given that a new state comes into power, how can you de-propagandize or de-radicalize these people so that they can work towards more progressive policies? Thank you.
Thank you.
I will think about that. But first, non-voter, I think the answer is yes and no. So on one hand, as a symbolic gesture, it's powerful when you have a big, if it is a majority, right, non-vote. But non-voters actually really show up together. However, I think if it falls short and just, you know, not voting and that's it, and therefore the impact will also stop there. The question is not so much about voting or not voting, but how the non-voters actually organize themselves and show that you, that whatever the state, that the society and the people actually need alternative rather than these two, you know, this discourse, and how to mobilize that, that's actually a real work. And I don't have, I mean, I cannot explain right now, but I think social movement is the only answer, and social movement is a long process, which is kind of like, go to the second one. I think it's very hard to unpack or to really organize against a long history of domination of the state where media is part of it. talking about media, if you look at Southeast Asia, yes, Indonesia might have, looks like there are many, Malaysia looks like there are many corporation and or Philippines, but really they belong to the elites. There's high media concentration and high concentration of media ownership in Southeast Asia. And part of those people, even though they are not state, corporations sometimes behave on behalf of the state. So how to unpack that? It's about political economy of it, right? And you cannot just simply undo, right? The people cannot undo. We are talking about the mass and long trajectory of networks, networking, and mobilizing from below, but also there is no social movement without allies from the so-called disaffected elites. How to have allies beyond the grassroots, I think, is very important. And it takes how many years of French Revolution? It's not finished yet. So, right.
Well, I think, you know, states have typically been in the hands of political and economic elites. You know, that there is an almost eternal union between the power of money and the power of, you know, those who control political institutions and armed forces. I think when you have political leaders or generals who have sinister motives by, you know, to keep themselves in power, or in the case of Burma, to derail the popular demand for, you know, further human rights and democratization, you know, under Suu Kyi's leadership, they turn to hatred, yeah? And fear and hatred are two surefire ingredients of a very, very effective politics. And then that, you know, to play that is like playing fire. You usually, and whoever played this game, put their own societies and people on a path of self-harm, and quite possibly, in the case of fascist society, total self-destruction. In the case of Japan, militarism in the 20s and 30s. In the case of Nazi Germany, you know, fascist Italy. And look at Brexit. Brexit did not happen by accident. Yeah? Margaret Thatcher sowed the seed in 1988 in a famous speech called Bruges Speech, where she articulated, you know, the English or British nationalism vis-a-vis European superstate, which she was opposed to. And, you know, fast forward Cameron's time.
Shall we keep it on Southeast Asia?
And then, so, you know, so what I'm saying is that any elites that mobilize people's prejudices, pre-existing prejudices, will end up harming their own societies. And how do we undo this? Well, I mean, like my colleague on this panel said, it will take a long time. You know, like genies out of the box. It's hard to put the hatred back in. Political leaders can come and make a deal. But the popular prejudices cannot be put back. Mm. You know, social movements alone is not enough. Social movements have to be anchored in essentially ideological, intellectual radicalization, you know, in the positive direction.
Thank you. We have 12 minutes left, so I'm going to squeeze in a couple more questions. We've got two people sitting next to one another here who've both got a question. Thank you.
Hi, I've got a question for Isabel, because I think the conversation has been very much about what the state is doing to control different populations and roll back democratic gains. But Isabel, maybe if you could share from your research, what are you seeing happening at the grassroots level in terms of interreligious groups, inter-ethnic groups, mm-hmm. who are trying to protect that space, because democracy is not an endpoint, right? It's an ongoing process. So what are some of the projects or activists or groups that you've met who are trying to make sure that those gains aren't rolled back so far?
Thank you, and we'll take the second question as well at the same time.
Thank you very much. I have two questions. The first question is for Ms. Isabel Dunstan. So you've just mentioned the generational gap and how to engage the younger generations on the kind of social media platforms. But I'm wondering, just can you elaborate a little bit more on kind of your observation about how, for example, Indonesian younger kind of social media users are behaving or like expressing themselves differently, what kind of opinions they're holding, are they different? How are they different from the older generations? And the second question for all the panelists, basically, we were talking about creating a kind of more inclusive kind of public sphere where everyone can have a voice on social media platform, of course. And then how do we do that in the day that the government or the state authority can not only kind of control the expression, control the speech, like basically what people can say or cannot say by for example, the fake news acts and everything else, but also in some other cases, for example, in China, like the state actually created their own network, internet platform that they can produce and kind of disseminate contents to teach and educate people. So how we kind of regulate state authorities in the public sphere to kind of increase a more kind of equal sphere of expression for both the civil society and also maybe state, because they do have some voices that should be heard. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Isabel, you go ahead.
All right. Thank you so much for the questions. So I just wanted to just quickly add about the topic on polarization. The polarization has been the word of the year to help us understand democratic processes around the world. But I do actually think that it's a reductive term to describe Indonesia's democratic process, particularly with the elections this year, because I think that there is a feeling now that the two candidates that people were voting for were, two sides of the one coin. And if you were observing any of the electoral debates throughout the campaign, you could see that one candidate was promoting economic reform and development, and one focusing on defence. And it left the public with not much to work with in terms of what were the ideological beliefs, what were the differences between them, what did they really stand for, as opposed to 2014 when President Jokowi really did win the vote among the indigenous groups and made a lot of promises around human rights, and he was starkly different to Prabowo. So this time around, I think it's very difficult to talk about polarisation when we had two candidates, two sides of one coin, and now we can see that Jokowi has actually, essentially removed his opposition, or at least, narrowed down his opposition to the PKS, and that's quite potentially quite dangerous. But to answer the questions about the grassroots protections to tackle disinformation and news literacy, I did talk about government response and internet governance specifically from the Ministry of Communication, but obviously there are an enormous group of organisations who were promoting fact-checking and news literacy, Turn Back Hoax, Check Factor. Mafindo is one of the leading organisations in that space, and they were collaborating with the tech giants, I think, far more than the government were. And I believe that this is a much healthier way to go about tackling disinformation, which is basically laying out all of the fake news out there and being able to align that with malign actors rather than blocking it and censoring it from the public. And also there was a huge movement of news literacy at the grassroots level. In terms of the younger generations and their views, obviously this is a really important question. I don't have data with me about who young people mostly voted for, but my thinking now is it was President Jokowi. And also the Millennial Party that ran didn't actually get any seats in the parliament this year, unfortunately. But I think that in terms of their views, we saw that the goalpost movement, which is the non-vote movement, was predominantly youth-oriented, which was quite concerning, I think. The goal put, which is the idea of punching in the white paper and not actually drawing in the ballot box in the little square. But I think that, yeah, that we're seeing more representation in Parliament and the Ministry now, with potentially Nadim, who has just been elected as the Minister of Education, who is the CEO of Gojek. He's the first millennial that's been appointed in the Ministry, and that's a potentially exciting or confusing appointment, given that he hasn't got any education governance experience. But I guess we can watch that space and see what happens.
Yeah. Thank you. So we've got 5 minutes left. Dr. Lim, did you want to speak to the question about how to create a more inclusive public sphere, briefly?
That's a very it's very difficult to answer because it's very complicated, right? I think on one hand, I think the political system itself needs to accommodate the existence of the fifth state, which is the media. So the media. On the other hand, the media itself, we have to question the position. Is the media or are the media in Southeast Asia really have been acting as the pillar of democracy? So these are two things that, and also I think civil society, on one hand, I'm excited about the emergence of civil societies and millennial being engaged. On the other hand, also we have a long history of civil society that seemingly are civil society, but not, they're not quite critical of the state. So we have, at least within these three prongs approach, we have a lot of homework to do. And society, I think, the public sphere ideally would emerge from this multiple sphere, and then people have to work together to create a very conducive landscape for public sphere to, inclusive public sphere to emerge.
Dr. Zani?
Well, I think the idea of democratic and progressive public space, that is always, that is something that needs to be renewed every generation. You know, I think like Champa says something like, democracy is not an end point, a point in history where you have reached. You know, that's why you've got the regressive politics happening in a country like Thailand, for instance. You know, during Thaksin's time, whatever his flaws and shortcomings, he unleashed something that no Thai political leaders and systems up to his time had ever done, which was like, you know, out of his own ulterior motives, he'd enfranchised the rural masses. And so the state found itself, the elite, you know, the monarchy, the Bangkok elite, as well as the military, they found themselves in a situation where they could no longer control their public space. That's why you've got the red shirts and the yellow shirt royalists. And so they shut it down, yeah? But in a place like Burma, there was an emerging public space, ironically, triggered by the coming of the power by the ex-general. This was like a controlled reform process that, created this public space. That the military mobilized the public space and filled the expectations of the public with racism rather than greater demands for the political liberalization. And so the same in China before Tiananmen Square as well. A political space emerged and the progressive forces had to fight with the authoritarian or neo-totalitarian state forces, and whoever wins shape that public space. So the public space itself is very similar to the public opinion. It's always perpetually shaped, and by forces at work.
Thank you. I'm afraid we've run out of time. It would be good to keep discussing all of these issues, but please join me in thanking our three panelists for a really fantastic panel.